Oh, hey there. I am Guy Branum, and today is not just a normal episode of Pop Rocket. Today is the most glamorous night in podcastery, the most anticipated moment in entertainment internet radio. It is the Academy of Pop Culture Arts and Sciences Awards of Merit, the first annual Pop-Tart Awards.
Woohoo!
With me today to determine the greatest achievements from 2015 in TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist Margaret Wappler. Margaret, who are you wearing?
I'm wearing a live cheetah skin that was cut by Bjork's son.
It smells amazing.
Academic and DJ Oliver Wang. Oliver, who are you wearing?
Let's see. From top to bottom, I have a Harris Tweed cap made by Hannah. One of my favorite sweaters, which is a lamb's bull V-neck by Scott and Charters, made for Union Made. My flannel shirt and moleskin pants are both from Land's End, and I'm on my feet. I'm wearing vintage Shell Cordovan floor sheen imperials.
It looks real good.
Thank you. I lust for them. Yeah.
And as you may have recognized from the absence of a hello, hello this week, we are down one Winter Mitchell. But luckily, here in the Maximum Fun Studios, there is a glass case containing USC professor and karaoke master, Karen Thompson. Karen, who are you wearing?
Just breaking out of the glass, but I have to say that I'm wearing lesbosensible El Nino appropriate clothing. And that means a Stephen Allen shirt, a wool tie by Rag & Bone, some sensible Levi's, and even more sensible multi-weather appropriate Red Wing leather lesbo boots.
Oh, let me see.
And a very nice zip sweater, too.
There you go.
From the age of 14 until graduating from law school, would get a pair of Red Wing boots every 2 years just in case I needed to do construction.
Well, there you go.
Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Absolutely. And I would have loved your parents, apparently. So.
And I am wearing a Brooks Brothers shirt, and everything else is Ralph Lauren because that is the only acceptable things that there are at the Big and Tall store. You guys, we have been doing this show for an entire year. We started out in January of last year, and this is our official one-year anniversary, and it couldn't have synced up better. Because we're going to look back at 2015, a year that we have covered extensively, and we're going to talk about the stuff that we loved most from pop culture, because this is a show about what we love to love. And today we're going to talk about what we loved to love to love. but
love it harder, as Ariana Grande would say.
To start us off, we're going to give our respect back to you guys, because it's been a long year with a lot of really great reviews for us on iTunes, and we wanted to select with our first Pop-Tart the single finest reviewer name on iTunes. Margaret, who do you think had the best name?
I have to give it to, and I counted how many yeps are actually in yep's name, and it's six. So, yeah, for you, Winter, yep.
All right.
Oliver, who do you think had the best name?
So I thought that yep would definitely be the runaway winner. But the more I thought about it, it wasn't the writing. It was the performance. Because without Winter doing that, I don't think it would have stood out to me. And I went through all the five-star reviews. And I thought it would be, maybe a couple hundred. We have 500-plus reviews total. Over 400 of them at minimum are five-star reviews. So we have a lot of really, really generous listeners out there.
We appreciate it.
And
Oliver's
we very much appreciate it.
Oliver's the best statistician ever.
And if I had to go with cleverness, I kind of got to go with Public Emily, just because.
It is very clever.
Yes.
It's very nice work. Karen Thompson, who do you think had the best review?
Public Emily is a great one. But because I'm a Pop Rocket dilettante and special guest star like Charo on The Love Boat, I'm going to go with something that just charmed me as a kind of funny, quirky thing. Hello Kitty is definitely a lesbian, in part as an homage to the Japanese American National Museum's Hello Kitty show that was a huge success this year here in L.A., but also because Hello Kitty is definitely a lesbian.
Why?
Right.
I mean, she has a lot of twinning situations going on with the other kitty.
Yeah.
She's not super into dresses and, really into sensible overalls.
That's very solid.
The whole deal. And she loves being at the forefront of a lot of machinic jobs.
I personally am going to give props to Drama Khaleesi. It is a great name. But I think we maybe all have to agree that Public Emily is like the best.
That is,
we'll give it to her.
It's clever, concise, and sly.
And presumably that is actually her name, in which case that, you know, makes it even better.
Public Emily, congratulations. You are the first recipient of a Pop-Tart Award.
Woo!
It's like the supporting actor or actress award that the Oscars give out first, just to kind of make people keep watching, but then they do all the boring
whetting everyone's appetite.
It's
before
the Irving Thalberg Award.
No. I'm going to say it's Best Supporting Actress. Irving Thalberg is in the middle, and that's somebody, like, that's statement-y. That's a big producer.
Okay.
All right, you guys. Now we have to slog through all of the technical awards.
Okay.
Now, actually, we're starting out with awards that each of us get to individually give. To celebrate the one thing that we personally, regardless of what these other assholes think, think was one of the best things that 2015 had to offer pop culture-wise. I will hand out the first one. My Tart of Merit goes to Mallory Ortberg and The Toast. Women in comedy are so frequently encouraged to play a man's game, to show that you can do what the boys do really well. In the world of stand-up, that's been the dominant theme for so long. And The Toast just stepped forward. It's lack of fear of specificity is one of the things that was most daunting to me, that it went out and wasn't just a humor blog that was targeted, that was mostly written by women, like not really targeted to women, just mostly written by women. But its willingness to be academic, its willingness to be obscure, like the love affair that they have with the Mitford sisters is a thing that like makes me mad and at myself for not being more unabashedly in love with the stuff that I'm in love with. And I'm pretty unabashedly in love with the stuff that I'm in love with. The voices on that site are so strong. Like, it just did such a great job of showing us what entertainment is in a world where you have all of the options, where appealing to everyone doesn't matter anymore. I mean, sure, Ridiculous 6 is doing fine on Netflix, but it isn't scared of not being for everyone. It understands the people who it is for and loves them and takes care of them. And the fact that Slate just made Mallory the new Dear Prudence got me so excited to realize that maybe mainstream outlets would understand that this is the future, that the future is not being scared of your own specificity.
You know what's amazing about that Mallory Ortberg Dear Prudence assignment is that there is now this incredible resurgence of female advice columnists.
Yeah.
I mean, there
yeah.
are so many good ones, from like Cheryl Strayed doing her whole Dear Sugar thing, to Heather Havrileski at The Cut writing brilliant things there. I feel like it's this amazing turn from like the old-fashioned, you know, Dear Abby, tis, tis, watch your manners kind of thing, into blowing it out into this like beautiful venue of life, thought, and advice.
Well, it's so funny. In a world where we really do love being wry and condescending to the hokey, for this hokiest of forms to say, no, we're going to pick somebody who's going to be right and who's going to be really smart about it and is going to be really funny about it. And also just a shout out to the fact that the world of gay comedy can be poorly constructed. Like, it is a territory that is a lot of hack jokes done by drag queens that can be pretty straight down the middle. And gay men haven't necessarily taken to more sophisticated kinds of comedy. God knows that that's an issue for me. But that Mallory has always been so, like, present with her gayness, and while at the same time not being anyone's cliche of what a lesbian is, and sort of like representing this very delightfully Victorian lesbianism that of course is like rich in history.
I would say it's Austenian. It's Jane Austen. Sense and sensibility and, like, you know, and the wit and incisiveness that just has that little turn that, like, appeals to you in a particular way.
And the thing is like, what I'm bitching about is that Mallory Ortberg is one of the best voices in gay comedy today, and nobody at Out or The Advocate cares. You know, like, and nobody at Queerty, and that she is like a gay voice, a gay woman's voice that is like so appealing to gay men. But it's just not something we talk about because it's not one of those tropes we know work. It's not a sassy diva talking about how drunk she gets. It's somebody being smart and subtle and wonderful.
Yeah, it's not about the bluntness of humor, but about the wit, again, in this particular, as you were saying, Victorian vein,
yeah,
or kind of Austenian, like just like sharpness,
yes,
and incisiveness.
You're right, I'm wrong. It's Regency, not Victorian.
It's Regency.
You guys,
that's
I just got off
deal.
Work. All right, so my tart demerit goes to Mallory Ortberg and the Toast. Oliver, who are you giving your tart to?
It's going to be to Black Lives Matter on for a number of reasons. I think one is that it's one of the first
to make me seem shallow.
No, not at all. I mean, for one thing, I think
to make all of us seem shallow.
It to me, it lies at this really fascinating intersection between it certainly exists as a social movement, but it's one that began as a social media movement, and I think the lines are quite blurred between how do you separate the two. They are inseparable. And I think more importantly than just its origins coming from Twitter as a hashtag to something that has a much broader, greater resonance, it's that for years now, I think one of the common laments has been that we simply don't talk about race well in pop culture. And we've continually looked to – and I think in a way that was naive, that we want our pop culture figures to sort of do that work for us rather than having our community leaders and our political leaders do it. And I think with Black Lives Matter, what we've seen here is that this is a grassroots movement that's been taken up, you know, primarily by Black women to begin with, who've now turned it into something that's much bigger than where it began. And now we finally have this moment where we're talking about race in a critical, unflinching, uncomfortable way that, thank God, because it's been long overdue. And, you know, looking forward into 2016 and beyond, you know, and maybe this is the point which I sound naive about it, but I feel like we've made a turn in terms of how we interrogate race and racism and anti-blackness and white supremacy in the U.S. I don't foresee that going away anytime soon. To me, this is not a flash in the pan. I mean, the hashtag might go in whatever direction it does, but I think the idea in which no one's going to be willing to let go of and I don't want to use conversation because I'm so sick and tired of hearing about the conversation around race, but I think that the idea in which we talk about race and racial inequality, I feel like that has become a semi-permanent part of just politics and culture in a way that is again, long overdue. It is incredibly necessary, and I think a lot of that begins with what Black Lives Matter was able to do this past year.
Nice. Margaret, who are you giving your tart to?
I want to give it to TV documentaries because there were two that I saw this year that really moved me, I think more than maybe anything else I saw on the screen. One of them being What Happened, Miss Simone, the documentary from HBO about Nina Simone. And I think part of the reason that really moved me is because it felt so timely, despite the fact that her story is, you know, really grounded in the 50s and 60s and 70s. But the issues that she was fighting about, and of course, this ties into what Oliver was talking about with Black Lives Matter, the issues that she was talking about back then are still obviously incredibly resonant now. And, you know, a song like Mississippi Goddamn has even more like weight and tenor and just energy to it now, considering that the violence that she was singing about back then is still happening and happening, you know, at the hands of government and police and so forth and so on. So I just think that, you know, it amazes me when something can be pulled out from another era and still have all this kind of import to now.
And after half a century of narratives about the civil rights movement that were very simple and direct because they needed to be, because there were a lot of people who were trying to tug and pull at them, being able to look at something that was such a fascinating intersection of race and gender and mental illness and like respect this woman and her artistry and look at her journey without having to hide any of these truths,
right,
was just so amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the fact that she was just so tortured, just as like almost as sort of a literary character in, you know, the fabric of pop culture, she just has this really like tragic Shakespearean kind of element to her story. The other one that I saw that I found just incredible as a piece of storytelling as well was Frontlines Inside Assad's Syria. And the reason that I really like this particular episode of Frontline, I mean, Frontline has always been doing amazing work of just cutting into stories deep that are really thorny and difficult to figure out and difficult to break down. But I mean, when you walk into Syria, you are really walking into one of the most quagmire, confusing situations you can possibly walk into. And their handling of it is so deft and so critical at this time. You know, you really get to learn about Assad's regime. You learn about the insurgents. You learn about ISIS. You learn about how all three of these different parties, you know, the way that they have traction in the country and why they have the traction that they do. And, you know, something happens, you know, without spoiling anything in the documentary, something happens kind of early on that's unusual for a documentary like that. And so you get to see, just on a pure technical journalism level, you get to see them sort of react to something that happens in a really kind of, again, just really deft way. And it was so impressive. And it was another one that just felt incredibly timely to me, where it was like the big kind of question mark in the sky to me of like, what is this place? You know, how is it rippling out into the whole world? And what, how can I understand it?
That's awesome. So Margaret's tart goes to TV documentaries. And Karen?
My tart goes to something with a really tardy name,
uh-huh.
but that I think has a much more profound kind of relationship to like our contemporary cultural sphere than anyone would give it credit for because of that, because of the tardy name. And that's Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
Rachel Bloom's wonderful show, which she co-runs with Aileen Brosh McKenna. And I was particularly really taken by, touched by, and hailed by the episodes on kind of Filipino-American life
yeah.
in the Inland Empire in the suburbs of Los Angeles.
Why would you relate to that, Karen?
I mean, why would I possibly relate to that? But I do feel like there's something about the way the show is, particularly the Thanksgiving episode, which was episode 6 of season 1, which was written by Rene Goubé, who was also an actor who starred as Father Bra in the previous episode. He's one of the executive story editors of that show. That really, I feel that this particular episode, that the way that Crazy Ex-Girlfriend deals with suburban Filipino-American life in a kind of adjacent way to its central character, this kind of neurotic Jewish girl from New York off meds way, was just so on point. It was as if someone downloaded my cerebral cortex and touched upon my heart chakra all at the same time. You know, like, as she says, who wouldn't want to be surrounded by the warmth of 100 unjudgmental Filipinos or something of that sort, the unconditional love of 100 Filipinos, that kind of thing. And to the argument that the main character, Vincent Rodriguez, plays Josh Chan, talking about wanting to sit next to the turkey so he could eat the skin, to, I don't know, all these the really subtle points about what it is to be a part of a kind of particularly not just Asian American, but specifically Filipino American diasporic community in relation to this kind of bizarre sprawl of suburbia in Southern California, and also to have that transpire as musical theater.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to have that happen through a song called I Give Good Parent with a kind of hip hop, like, you know, parodic element to it. I mean, I think that there was nothing in this entire year of popular culture that felt more resonant to me.
I feel with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend exactly how I felt with Jane the Virgin last year, of coming into it just late enough that the first 4 episodes are off Hulu. And I'm like, oh, God, I can't go in from the start. And I've been like absorbing Jane the Virgin. But I feel like with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I do kind of just need to jump in episode 4 and take it down any way I can.
Just to raise a quick related tangent, I mean, Karen, would you agree that you think was 2015 the year that Asian Americans finally arrived on television?
To a certain extent, yeah. I mean,
it's not parody, but
well,
it's,
yeah, I think to a certain extent, yes. And also what attests to that is the fact that there is a specific Filipino-American plotline on a network show.
Right.
Because actually one of the things that I you know, when Crazy Ex-Girlfriend
Calling
started...
Calling the CW a network is generous.
Yes. Well, I do understand that...
It's
you
like
know,
a loose
yeah,
concept.
Like a big... The big 17 or whatever.
Yes.
But, you know, when the character, Josh Chan, was introduced, I was like, okay, this actor is obviously Filipino, but they're going to just turn him into a Chinese guy because that's what most other American viewers are familiar with. And the fact that they then started to incorporate all of these really specific kind of configurations, not only around Filipino families, but like, you know, Filipino guy dating a Latina woman, like involved with a, you know, flirtatiously with a neurotic Jewish lady. I mean, whatever. Obviously, that's my life. So, you know, I can't even let that go.
Or the fact that he's from West Covina. Which
and
the
West Co. Yeah. Like, that's the thing. Yeah. It's like the specificity of that Jew. It is so smart about L.A. and Southern California geographies and how they signify and what they mean. It's like, oh, you know, West Covina, it's 2 hours from the beach, 4 hours in
which,
traffic.
Technically not true. That did kind of
not
annoy
true.
Me.
That was. It's only like if you went to Crystal Cove, it would be only like, you know, 70 minutes.
Exactly.
You guys, we need this time for the other awards.
Okay.
You're listening to Pop Rocket's first annual Pop Tartar Awards. We will be right back after this.
Hi, this is Sheila from Helsingborg, Sweden. And I listen to Bullseye because they're less like interviews and more like great conversations.
Jesse is so well-researched and so articulate and so passionate about the subjects that he interviews.
You can really just feel a kinship.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Nico Case and Herb Alpert on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. You are listening to the first annual Pop Tart Awards. With me to hand out our citations for the best in pop culture this year are
Karen Tongson,
Margaret Wappler,
Oliver Wang.
Now we're going to head through about six or seven categories we've yet to decide and determine some specific categories of best things in pop culture this year. Let's start it out with one that I am going to definitely lose about. Let's talk about what you thought the best song of 2015 was, Oliver.
It came down to either Drake's Hotline Bling, which I think if you had to pick the best pop single, that would win. But if it's the best song, and part of this does go back to sort of my tart of merit, I would lean more towards Kendrick Lamar's All Right, which has become sort of a modern-day protest song. And in fact, has appeared at protests. You know, the lyrics to it appear underneath the Vertigo Club sign in downtown Los Angeles, which seems hella random. I think, you know, those two songs, I think, in very different ways commanded part of the, you know, the zeitgeist, if you will. I mean, if I had to choose between them, I'm going to go with Kendrick.
You're just giving nominees right now.
All right, sorry.
Margaret, give us a nominee or two.
I want to throw in Missy Elliott's Where They From, because I love the video and I love that she's back. I love that she just triumphantly stormed back in and just took it over. I also love Drake's Hotline Bling, but in a way, almost for the videos that it spawned.
Yeah.
But it is one of those songs that every time I'm turning on the radio and I catch it, I will land on it. And the same is true, and God help me for saying this, the same is true about Justin Bieber's What Do You Mean? Like, I am down with that, like, Toto, like, you know, rain stick sound that's going on in there. And so, yeah, I'm going to throw that in. And then...
You want to argue all day, make love all night?
All right.
My life, Justin. My life.
Okay.
Anyway...
Karen, who have you got?
Okay, I've got Bieber on my list, and Bieber only, but Bieber with Skrillex and Diplo. Where are you, umlaut, now? And, you know, and I'm going to give it up, like, number one, because it is actually the song that reintroduced us to Justin Bieber as an actual talent, but also because of the way, I mean, the production of that song is just like amazing, from the kind of plaintive, like, croony R&B thing that starts it to the wet, crotchy marimba, like, drop your pants beat that's like boom, boom. And then the da-da-da-da, which sounds to me like it's been sampled from one of those Chinese fiddles, a.k.a. the Eru, on top again of those wet, crotchy marimba beats. And it is just fucking amazing.
That's Arhu, by the way.
Arhu, sorry. Eru, Arhu.
Does anyone want to speculate what my two nominees are?
Mm. I could speculate, but I could also just read.
Yes.
So.
Well, no, it's only going to be, look. Macklemore and Ryan Lewis's Downtown changed me this year, okay. And I'm the only human being for whom that is true. And I love it a lot. But also, I will say, Taylor Swift's Bad Blood. And I realized the album came out in 2014, but the single was released in May. And that song grew on me so hard. I started off being like, this isn't a, like, Shake It Off had immediate charms. But Bad Blood, as it went on and as it sort of, like, got the cultural cachet of it being this song of female solidarity, but also being a song about backstabbing. I mean, you could read it as being a song about a girl and a guy, but it's just the subtlety of the way that she's implying that she was hurt is like, no, a woman hurt her.
Isn't it Katy Perry who hurt her?
That's the rumor.
Okay. That's reasonable. I should know.
Slash fiction. Totally happening.
All right. Let's go to the real conversation. It appears that Hotline Bling or Bieber's...
Something from Bieber.
Where are you now? What are our thoughts? I mean, Hotline Bling was a really fun song, but it felt like it was being consumed half in irony and half legitimately. It felt like everyone was sneering at the same time that they were appreciating it. I think
it's the
great.
Video people were laughing at. Yes. They were laughing at his dancing. But I feel like the song was legit, like accepted 100%.
All right, Margaret.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a lot of reasons to love
Missy Elliott. I don't want to just
Missy
give a sloppy Pop-Tart. You know what I mean? Yeah. I want to really figure this out.
All right. Try to convince either Karen or Oliver to come with us for Missy Elliott. What, like...
I mean, Missy Elliott was gone for, what, 10 years or something like that?
Yeah.
And she comes back with this airtight video that is still 100% her style, yet felt like now. You know what I mean? It wasn't like,
but it's
like,
the video, not the song. Can you remember a verse from it?
Okay.
I mean, I could, like, hum something.
Oliver, having heard everybody's nominations, what are your thoughts now?
I like WTF, but I think partly it's more about the return of Missy than the inherent quality of the song itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had to rank it across her other songs, it's a perfectly fine song. It's just not one of Missy's best songs, which would disqualify it for being a song of the year in that respect.
But I mean, the comeback factor, the fact that she drops after like 10 years.
Okay, by that token.
With that high quality.
By that token, Force Awakens was the best film of the year.
Okay.
No.
I can't do that. So
could you consent to Bieber?
I haven't heard it.
I feel like Oliver could not consent to Bieber.
But you haven't heard either one of them?
I've not heard any Bieber.
All right.
I'm Bieber free.
Do you not hear songs with umlauts in them or something?
Yeah.
I don't know. Does Bieber count? Does she have an umlaut?
we've run out of time. Bieber, Missy, or
Drake.
Or,
yeah.
Or Hotline Bling.
I would have to roll with Hotline Bling.
All right.
Yeah.
Margaret.
I mean, for the sake of peacekeeping.
No. Like...
Look, I just want to get along at this early stage.
I get that.
And I'm not going to fight that hard for this one because I will fight harder for other ones.
Oh.
So
right.
I'm willing to give Hotline Bling the Pop-Tart.
All right.
Ride or die for Bieber.
Okay.
Nice.
I'm gonna yeah. also go for Bieber, and I'm going to make Colin...
Colin has to decide.
Okay. So we're going to listen to some Bieber.
No. I'm already nixing it.
Do you hear the crotchiness of that beat?
It's a great song. But...
Explain crotchiness.
It's like it sounds like it's sagging and kind of at the same time.
Spanking the crotch.
No.
It's like saggy, tight, and a little bit moist. Sorry.
All right.
Very specific. Thank you very much.
The best song Pop-Tart for 2015 goes to Hotline Bling.
Okay.
All right.
All right, Drake.
Next up, best musical artist. I'm going to go with Taylor Swift. I'm going to say she was all over us this year in an overwhelming way that was difficult to deal with. But she gave us an album that had 5 or 6 fucking pop gems on it. Like, this is, if her career can ever match this in any way, she will be someone who is with us forever. It is, as a gay man in my 40s, it is beautiful to see that divas are still born.
As a gay man in my 40s, I would also say I would have said Taylor Swift had her album not come out in 2014.
Okay.
But my answer to this is the sleeper, Carly Rae Jepsen, who essentially executed near the end of 2015 what Taylor Swift managed to kind of sprawl out over like kind of 2014, beginning of 2015.
But nobody paid attention to it because she wasn't having fights with people.
Maura Johnston.
She's Canadian. She just doesn't do that.
You know, but like the thing is that album, Emotion,
yes,
is a gorgeous pop bauble. It is a pure crystalline pop bauble. Maura Johnston at the Boston Globe shouting her out. She wrote the most brilliant and beautiful review of this album, from talking about the chorus of its synthesizers to the fact that there is something about the way that this album functions where, like Katy Perry, who was the kind of cipher for the teenage dream, Carly Rae Jepsen in Emotion also manages to channel that, but with a certain kind of maturity and also like a level of fantasy that touches upon different sonic fantasies from the 80s, like the saxophones and the, you know, everything. I think that this is like the most underrated but best pop, and I'm going tardy, the best pop album of 2015.
Like, her music does have like a John Hughes movie quality to it at all times. Margaret, who are your nominees?
Well, I would say Kendrick Lamar, and I know that's going to make Oliver happy, but that's not why I'm saying it. I'm saying it because I feel like, I mean, you know, I'm happy to make you happy, but, you know, it's more about it's his year, it's his time. It's the album that everything about him coalesces into this album and is concentrated into pure, just magic Kendrick. I also think that when I saw him perform on Saturday Night Live, and he did like a medley, which is totally a stupid thing to do. Like, medleys are kind of terrible in and of themselves. Yet, he elevates the medley to something I've never seen before, where it really did just feel like this musical flow of his ideas. And it just, you know, I mean, there are artists that, like, I personally, you know, it's not like I have every Kendrick Lamar album, but I can recognize when it's just their time, where it's just like, this is the year for this guy. So just give it to him. You know what I mean?
Oliver, you're going to disagree with the Kendrick Lamar, right?
No. I think for me, if I had to choose the person who had the best kind of pop music year, I would lean more towards Drake, only because Hotline Bling was huge. And he also turned a diss song back to back. He turned it into like a radio and club hit, which is really difficult to do. I just think those 1-2 punch on a pop level are pretty hard to mess with. But if I had to think about the pop zeitgeist and who is the artist that, let's say, 10 years from now, when we think back to 2015, who is the artist who's going to loom the largest, I think that's going to be Kendrick Lamar. So Lamar would get my vote. Sort of in the same way that I think Lauryn Hill functioned in 98 or 99 whenever her album came out. It's just she just embodied that moment in a way that, I mean, and again, it's not to take anything from Drake, but I think Kendrick embodied 2015 in a way that no one else can quite match.
I would like to make a couple of points. First of all, I'm very mad that I just handed over Best Song to Oliver when it should have been, we should have gone hard poppier on song and let him have Kendrick Lamar for Artist of the Year. So I'm just going to say I'm no longer trusting myself for my best interest. So I am handing my vote in proxy to Ms. Karen Tongson.
But can I just say, like, in the context of Tarts?
Yes.
Choosing Kendrick Lamar as the musical artist of the year is like choosing the spinach tart over choosing Carly Rae Jepsen, who would be the fucking tardy cherry. Like, she would be the strawberry donut from Donut Man when it's in season. Yes. Like, that's what I'm saying. Let's go pop tart. He's the spinach or kale tart. He's good choice.
Okay.
He's
not
smart.
Even,
he's sensible. Okay. He's like the brand muffin of what we're going for.
Margaret, who's the pop compromise candidate that you could get behind?
See, I can't get behind Drake as an artist because I think he's a wanker. Like, I just think he's a jerk.
He's Canadian.
I can't, like, I don't like his hairline. I know that's a very shallow reason.
He made Serena lose the U.S. Open.
Yeah, he just messed too many things up. So I can't get behind him. And, you know, I had this loose thought, and I can barely even say it. Adele?
I mean,
No.
That's the brand muffin.
Why not?
That's the brand muffin.
I would go back to Taylor Swift. Adele is like the your TIAA Cref accountant's choice of who fucking the accountants if they chose the Oscars.
Yes.
That's who would win this. So, you know, Kendrick, like, he totally deserves this. If we're talking about artists, if we're talking about Pop-Tarts, it's Carly Rae Jepsen.
And interestingly, Bieber wasn't, as somebody who released an album this year, he wasn't
I was
going to
choose him too, but, like, you know, like, I think that his album is actually going to surge further and longer into 2016.
Yeah. All right, Margaret, can
we've got a standoff. This is difficult. I see Carly Rae, I gave that album a try and I just didn't
make the most of the night.
No, I did not. I did not have emotions to it.
All right. Okay. We're out of time. I'm going to say you guys want it more. You care about it more.
Yeah.
Kendrick Lamar, you received the Pop-Tart for best song. The thing is, it would have affected Carly Rae Jepsen's life. Like, one of her friends would have told her, hey, this podcast really liked your album.
She would have been a guest on Pop Rocket.
Yes. Kendrick Lamar don't give a shit.
He does exactly. not give a shit. Right. That's true.
All right. It is now time for the much vaunted Pop-Tart for Meme of the Year. Mm. This is broad definition. This is anything trucking through our culture. It can be something as simple as a little graphic meme. It can be something as gigantic as Shout Your Abortion. I personally am going to go with the amazing year that Man Buns had. Like, there were a lot of fashion trends that happened this year, but Man Buns came so hard from out of nowhere. We also had that trend of people showing videos of...
I disagree that it came out of nowhere. I think the Man Bun
Devandra
has
Banhart.
Been... It's been creepy. It's true. Devandra Banhart. It's been creeping out of the zeitgeist for many years now.
That's true. To you in Silver Lake. But to me in West Hollywood, it came out of nowhere.
Burn.
But like, I remember there were like this terrible video of South African guys going and cutting off dudes' man buns, and like there was like a brief moment that we were like, yeah, fuck those dudes. And then all of America was like, oh no, wait, we're encouraging people to go and like batter someone because of their gender expression. Maybe this is not okay.
That the man bun was thought of as a gender expression is just bullshit.
It's
really more an expression that you have pot on your body, on your person somewhere.
And in the episode of Pop Rocket that was hosted by Aaron Gibson and Brian Safi, Aaron's What Is Making Me Happy This Week was man bun celebrity Brock O'Hearn on Instagram. And so within man buns, I would like to just give props to Brock O'Hearn and his amazing work. I saw him at a cafe recently. He's like 6'7", and he's just like, you have to look at his Instagram. He's just always finding new flattering ways of photographing himself shirtless, and has been such a warrior for the man bun as a piece of culture. Karen.
Okay, so on the topic of kind of gender stuff, I'm going to say that the winning memes this year were like the various feminist memes, like Shout Your Abortion, Periods Are Not an Insult, and also the controversy around The Future is Female, which Rachel Burks, who runs the boutique Otherwild here in Echo Park, took great care and pains to secure the permissions for, but then was completely appropriated in a Celesbian manner by Carla Delevingne. And Delevingne, I can't even remember how to say her name.
Nobody does.
But also, I do want to say that, like, one of the things that struck me about, like, the proliferation of these assertive feminist memes was also still their imperviousness to the kind of intersectionality with something like Black Lives Matter or Say Her Name, like around Sandra Bland. So as much as I celebrate, like, you know, periods are not an insult calling out Donald Trump, I do feel like there's a way in which there has to be some more collaborative, politically integrative and intersectional critique that intersects with like the power of Black Lives Matter, of all these other memes.
Margaret.
Oh, this is tough. I mean, I want to say Black Twitter in general, especially around the whole Rachel Dolezal thing.
Yeah.
Like the comedy of that situation on Black Twitter was like unbelievable. Like just pitched so high. I really felt like it was the closest I'd ever come to like seeing Richard Pryor in his heyday or something.
Well, and to have such a moment and to have to be enjoying it so much, like to know that so many people are around both contributing and enjoying it was just delightful.
Yes. Like you could be part of it or you could just sit back and eat the popcorn and enjoy the show. I mean, I also, too, loved a lot of the feminist memes that were going around. I wasn't as crazy about Shout Your Abortion. Like, I had some issues with that meme in particular. And I say that having mad respect for Lindy West, but I don't think that's the best way to go about that whole argument. But that's a whole other topic. I do like Periods Are Not an Insult, partially because anytime I can tweet at Trump about my cycle, I'm in favor of it.
It's so much fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a way to keep track of things.
Oliver,
anything.
What do you got?
Let's see. My honorary mention would be the crying Jordan head meme, which is Michael Jordan at the Hall of Fame induction started crying, and there was a particular photograph of that where people splice his head off and began sticking it on anyone who was having a bad day, especially celebrities. They would just Photoshop crying Jordan head on top of it. And for whatever reason, like, it's always funny, and I feel bad for saying that because it's at sort of Jordan's expense, even though the guy's kind of a dick, so who cares? But I got to go. I think really the dress would be the meme of the year.
Take us through it.
Is it gold?
Right, exactly. So for those of you who don't remember the dress
don't
is
open up that it's can either of worms again.
It's either white or gold, or what were the
white and gold,
and
or purple and black, or right. Something weird.
And I think because it was such a perfect peak internet moment, like, it's something that could only exist in the internet in terms of the speed at which everyone wants to share it, wants to debate it, wants to, like, just to kind of be a part of it. And
everyone's
for that reason,
workplace stopped
yes.
for 2 hours
yes.
while you had this conversation, and you honestly could not understand why another person had another perspective. And there is a way that that was a perfect, like, a centralized representation of all of these other conversations of not being able to understand other people's perspectives. That, like, with something like Black Lives Matter or Shout Your Abortion, it is this politicized issue. But with the dress, it really was just standing and staring at someone and not having a reason and not understanding how they could think that motherfucker was anything but blue and black.
And it was sort of a viral moment that did not feel like it was manufactured.
It was white and gold.
What about the craziest thing is when it would switch on you?
No,
yeah, that was really weird.
And that's like some kind of deep metaphor for life. You know, when you think you know the answer and then it turns out to be something else.
It switched on me and I can't make it go back.
Yeah.
All right. I am completely behind the dress. Karen or Margaret, does either of you care to make it legit? Or
we've had our piece about more profound memes, but, like, the dress was a really kind of strangely fucked up moment. Yeah.
All right,
and I mean, it did bring the people together.
That looks purple.
That
and
looks
black.
White and gold to me right
white
now.
And gold. White and gold.
Purple and black.
See, Garrett. See,
congratulations.
Or blue and black, or whatever.
Congratulations, the dress. We hope that this is the first of but many awards this awards season.
Please don't ever wear it again. It's not attractive in any color.
So bad.
All right. Next Pop-Tart. We're going into big stuff now. Let's talk about what the best TV show of the year was. I got to tell you guys, we've had a lot of dramas that people love to talk about. But for me, it was that weekend watching Kimmy Schmidt and just crying and being delighted that I recently rewatched all 13 episodes. The jokes are so fucking golden. And realizing that this candy-colored story, it was fundamentally about feminism and about like that it was Mary Tyler Moore where Rhoda's a black gay guy, like that it's about these alliances between marginalized people, that it really doesn't have a place for a heterosexual white man at the heart of the show, like, kind of great. And then also Fresh Off the Boat. We all know that I love Fresh Off the Boat. It is another family comedy. And there are some really good family comedies on ABC right now. Modern Family is still really good. Wendy McClendon Covey does amazing work on The Goldbergs, but how much the writing and the performances of Fresh Off the Boat were just undeniable, such that all of America had to love this show, not just Asian Americans finally getting some representation. Either of those would work for me. Margaret, what about you? What do you think the best show of the year was?
Are we talking about new shows?
We're talking about best shows this year. If something had an amazing fourth season, tell us about that amazing fourth season.
Okay. Well, for me, new shows, I would definitely say Unreal, hands down. I just think it was the most innovative. It was the most clever. It's definitely so timely in the sense that it takes on this albatross that we've been dealing with in culture now for years, the whole reality TV machine, and then sort of spins it on its own head, and also manages to show, I think, probably the most complex, like, female characters that I saw in that kind of TV show.
Female anti-hero of a sort. Like, we've had a lot of dudes who were troubled and broke the law, but, like, Unreal gave us women who were unlikable in many ways, but fucking relatable. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
And the level of just psychology and manipulation, it's all just really tasty, and I cannot wait to see what they're going to do with the next season. I also just have to give a couple of honorary shouts out. I do think, like, the Mad Men final episode is worth really talking about, because it's a hard thing to wrap up a show like that. A show that's been going and been collecting accolades, but at the same time has definitely had its missteps, has definitely made some kind of strange turns that didn't totally pan out. And I think even that season, you know, had a couple of rough spots. But that last show, I think, was pretty pitch perfect. And I think the way that it ended was just a perfect, perfect send off.
Oliver?
I'd go with Master of None. Though these are all personal choices. I don't think I can make a strong case for it for being hands down the best television show of the year, but it's the one that I like the most. I think part of it was, I mean, there's the fact that it's like Aziz Ansari, the fact that it's an Asian American guy behind it, and that it's good, that it's competent, that it's sweet, that it's kind of funny, that the music is good. Every element to it I really enjoyed. And I think perhaps in this case, I'm giving it extra value because of the surprise factor. I would not have guessed that Aziz Ansari would do a really good television show, and he did, which makes me like it all the more.
Karen, what about you?
I would go with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, but it's still in process. But as you know from the last time I think I sat in here, The Affair has blown my mind, Sarah Trame's show. And again, I can never get enough of like insane hetero disaster porn. I can't ever get enough of also like the riveting performances that the ensemble has produced, from good old Pacey Josh Jackson to, again, the brilliant Maura Tierney. And now I'm forgetting the two British people's names.
Dominic West,
who was, you know, on The Wire and all that stuff. And gosh, what's her name?
Right.
Allison something. No, that's Alice, the name of the character.
Right.
But Ruth Wilson. In any case, so wonderfully written, such a kind of at once a great detective story and barn burner, but also real meditation on privilege, desire, sexuality, the kind that I haven't seen in a long time.
Are there any of these others that you could get behind?
Oh, man. I mean, I could get behind the last episode of Mad Men. The thing about Master of None is I really enjoyed it and I thought it was pleasurable, but I felt that, like I feel about some Netflix shows, that it could have cooked a little longer before it came out.
Why?
I think that there are ways in which it's sort of, hey, Aziz Ansari's behind this. Let's like crank these episodes out. And there are like a couple of sketches and kind of funny little things and interludes in between, but like a kind of coherence across the entire series missing.
There was something, and pilots are frequently different from the rest of the show, but that pilot was mediocre. It wasn't until the second episode that I loved it. And there are some episodes of that season that I just think are stellar. And then there are some episodes that I was like, okay.
I could also get behind Fresh Off the Boat for Network. I haven't seen Unreal yet.
Okay. Unreal's fucking amazing. And I feel like I could definitely give it to Unreal. Oliver, I know you like Fresh Off the Boat. Do we, between the two of these, which do you feel is more worthy? I mean, my gut says Unreal, because Fresh Off the Boat is good and it is good, strong writing. But
it's good for Network.
But it's good for Network, and it is so much carried by a performance. Mm. Where Unreal was just, in the same way the Empire kind of was, new territory. Just like this world that we know that we haven't had a TV show about. And Shiri Applebaum was so good. Constance Zimmer was so good. Like all those bitches in, you know, who were playing bachelorettes were fucking killing it. Oliver, are you comfortable with us handing it to Unreal?
I haven't seen it, but this is not a category where I feel like I need to go to the mattresses on. So
all right. So your Pop-Tart for best TV show goes to Unreal. All right. You guys.
Okay.
We're in the final stretch. We only have two left. Best film, best performance. I will allow us to split best TV and best film performance, but let's do it. What did
I'm
you
ready.
Think? What did you think?
Best film
was the best film of the year. For me, and it's hack. Sometimes I feel on the show like hack talking about sort of like different representation and stuff, because we're talking about all pop culture and we happen to be a show that is a little bit more diverse than a lot of podcasts and people who are talking about pop culture. And sometimes I worry that it feels like we're covering a beat. But for me, like the movies that I love most this year really were Tangerine and Carol. And to a lesser extent, Mad Max, whatever, whatever. but Tangerine was fucking magical. Tangerine was just such a fun comedy. Like, there are so few comedies that you get to go to and just, like, are better than you expected they were going to be. I always want so much from a comedy. And it was just so fun and so alive the entire time. I watched it. I didn't know that it was shot on iPhones. I just loved it so much. And it was shot in the world where I live. And Todd Haynes can be not someone I'm a huge fan of. His work can be very distant. I feel like gay artists, there are the people who are all words and the people who are all images. And he's somewhere in the middle, but he is more images than I am. But this film was so lovely and so accessible. And like working from the Patricia Highsmith novel, A Price Above Salt, which was structurally like the lesbian porn novels of the time, but also a real novel that doesn't punish these lesbians at the end. So good, so delightful. A film that felt gigantic in a way that those little movies about a forbidden love don't always. It also made me finally get Rooney Mara. Those are my
thoughts. That's important because she's been flitting around now for a while, and I also feel
I've always
confused.
Got Rooney Mara.
Okay.
Karen.
So I also have to go with Carol in many respects, because of the kind of gorgeous subtlety, insinuation, the ways in which like desire and sexual sublimation played itself out in Todd Haynes's textural world through these gorgeous textiles and reflective shots and the kind of simmering and simpering and longing, the bewitched, bothered, and bewildered elements of homosexuality that are so often lost in the kind of push towards visibility and explicitness and like whatever, let everything I mean, you know, like there is obviously like a wonderful place for that, but there is something about the way that it limbed these really subtle notes of desire that I loved. But I do have to say, as a second shout out, as a companion piece, Olivier Assayas's The Clouds of Sils Maria to me was as if like the film Carol were allowed to talk. Uh-huh. Through its own kind of meta making.
I'm not familiar with that song. What is
and
it?
And it's so movie. That movie Sorry. Is about basically Juliette Binoche plays an aging actress, and her younger assistant is Kristen Stewart.
Oh wow!
Yes, absolute hotness, and Kristen Stewart is brilliant in it. But it is about Juliette Binoche's character played an ingenue, like the Rooney Mara character, who was seduced by an older lesbian in a previous film that was made by like an illustrious Swiss playwright. And it's all about like her now doing a remake of that on the stage and playing the older woman.
Oh, that's
who's
lovely.
The seductress. And so what the complaints that many of my lesbian friends and my queer female friends said about Carol is just like, well, you know, it lacks this particular kind of conversationality or texture. The Clouds of Sils Maria offers that in spades with a similar kind of aesthetic sensibility and suppleness and softness that's good.
The thing is I like things being said, mm-hmm. but still those car scenes where they are both so hungry to be able to reach out and connect with each other and so terrified that they don't, like, crackled from me in a way mm-hmm. that stuff like that usually doesn't. Margaret, what was your film of the year?
I haven't seen Carol yet, but I do love Todd Haynes. And I also liked Clouds of Sils Maria quite a bit. But for me, I still have to go with Spotlight. It's just the movie that I think is going to make the biggest. I mean, not that this is the only metric to judge anything by, but I really think it's going to like do well in all the awards because it's so just consummate as a film. Like, it's a stellar cast. The way that they handle this complicated, strange story that's set in sort of a tricky time period in the sense that it's only, you know, what, 10 years before. It's really pretty deft and ingenious in terms of how they handle telling the story that, you know, obviously is still playing out in the culture now.
And taking such a well-worn genre mm-hmm. as the investigative reporter movie, like a thing that we really learned how to do in the 70s. And then along the way, subverting it really nicely, not giving you a hero, making people look at the ways that they were complicit in a system. Like was really exciting.
Yeah, like just about everyone's hands is dirty, even the journalists themselves for ignoring the story for a while, for turning their back on it. So, yeah, that would definitely be my pick.
What about you, Oliver?
Well, I have to say, I'm convinced to go watch Carol now between all the love that has been shed upon it. My pick would be Mad Max Fury Road. And I think for me, in terms of as pure cinematic sensory spectacle and experience, no other film that I saw this entire year left me feeling like I just underwent something. I mean, Star Wars sort of hit all the nostalgia kid buttons, but it didn't provide sort of like this immense kind of just sense like, oh my God, I'm experiencing something that was much greater than I could have imagined.
Well, Mad Max has also just been a grittier, sexier, bigger world. Like, we all probably watched a Mad Max movie for the first time when you were a child, and it was a little bit too much. And there's something nice about going back to that and having it still have kind of that fear and that edge to it.
I mean, to me, it's telling that it's one of the few films I saw this year that I do not want to watch again because I know there's no way that I could relive that experience. I want to keep that experience pristine in a way that I think Spotlight is really, really well crafted. I would totally watch it again. But in some ways, I feel like that almost cheapens it because it just means that there's something that's more accessible about it, whereas Mad Max as a cinematic experience, that cannot be duplicated.
Karen, you had said that you knew some stuff about the production of Tangerine that like...
I mean, you know, and again, like, this is a lot of conjecture and, like, kind of inside AFI baseball. But, like, you know, it's just sort of that the story was – it was basically, you know, kind of a white, cis, heterosexual guy who came into the LGBT center and wanted to make a film about trans people and happened upon
Kitana Kiki. No, he actually talked to Maya Taylor first. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And just sort of like, okay, like, this sounds great. Like, let's get your stories down and let's, like – make it happen. And I'm just, and you know, and part of it, and this is coming from a queer filmmaking community, it's just sort of like, why doesn't anybody have writing credit or producing credit, especially the performers involved, like who really furnished this story and these landscapes and this place. And so, you know, again, I can't verify like all of these different things in between, but like, I do think that there's a way in which, you know, even though they're like they're allowed to perform in it, they're allowed to be the spectacles of this film. But sort of like, to what ends do we like then support their relationship to the production of it on another end?
Sean Baker did Brett Easton Ellis's podcast, and he talked a lot about the process and was very transparent about the extent to which those women participated in writing the story, and also were like, he was showing them cuts of the movie.
Yeah,
and the thing is to me, that's one of the things that makes it great, is that with stuff like this, there always is the question of why couldn't it be someone from within the community making it?
Or why don't they just get more credits or back-end shit? You know, that's a question.
That's very, very true and legit. Mm-hmm. That's true and legit. I mean, the thing is like, Sean Baker, I believe that's his name, he still lives with his parents. Like, nobody has kind of made money off of this movie. And I just so loved... The texture of Tangerine is something that would not have been possible if it were just dudes speculating about what these women's lives were like. It's not something that would have been possible with fucking Jared Leto in a dress.
Yeah.
And I just really felt that this attempt at collaboration that was respectful, that was like looking someone in the eye, there were things in that movie that are so clearly reflective of a trans person, like no straight guy would have understood that it is just randomly when the shit has gone poorly in your life that it's just like nobody beats anybody, like
gets piss thrown in their face,
that it is those subtle indignities that stack on top of all the other shit and make things terrible, but that it still manages to moments later be an optimistic movie is fucking powerful.
And that is powerful and beautiful, and that's why I'm just like, hey, give the lady a fucking writing credit.
Yeah.
That's all.
All
that's
right.
My thing.
All of you have made really, really solid arguments. Do any of the rest of you feel like there's something else here that you could stick to? It's hard because you guys haven't seen Carol, and I get that.
Haven't seen Carol. I did see Tangerine. I like Tangerine quite a bit, but there was something about the story structure for me that it just fell slack at certain times.
Yeah.
Like there was just sort of dead air in that movie at certain times where there was like too much of the, you know, Kiki Rodriguez. Yeah. Like, too much of her, like, dragging around the other girl, like, before it became obvious that the other girl wanted to sort of be friends.
Yeah.
Like, there's just those kinds of things that, for me, it just wasn't, like, snapped in tightly enough.
Yeah.
So when I think about the other movies that we've been talking about, I mean, I would almost say I could get behind Mad Max a little bit more, because I do agree that that movie, when I think back on it, it was like such an incredibly immersive experience in a way that that's pretty much unmatched. Like, I really felt like I was almost on like an amusement park ride the entire time I was watching that movie, where it's like you are just dunked into that whole world.
Karen, can you get behind Mad Max?
Because I was watching all of these like insane, either chatty or not chatty lesbian films, I never saw Mad Max. So I, like, in my tart evaluation, spinach versus cherry galette, whatever the hell, I'll just go with the popular film that is the consensus.
All right. Yes.
I mean, I could give it to Carol. I'm just saying.
Sight unseen.
I don't mean to just throw a monkey wrench in here or a cinnamon Pop-Tart or whatever.
I mean,
but
I feel like on the Pop-Tarts, the fact that the two of you haven't seen Carol is to some extent reflective of the way that Carol hasn't penetrated the way that, well.
Oh, my goodness.
The way that
she listen. there
right.
can be penetration, I hear.
Mad Max Fury Road, congratulations. You are the recipient of the first annual Pop-Tart for Best Film. You are listening to the Pop-Tart Awards on Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this.
Are you troubled by a lack of astute yet dick joke-filled analysis of bad movies?
Do you experience feelings of laughter and enjoyment when you hear three friends go off on stupid tangents?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, ghost, or totally rad party dude house cat who really only exists as a sound effect?
If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then pick up your podcast listening device of choice and subscribe to The Professionals.
The Flophouse.
Our award-winning and usually only a little drunk staff is on call 24 hours a day to serve all your bad movie podcast needs.
The Flophouse. We're ready to make you laugh in public so that other people look at you funny.
Hit it!
I'm pretty sure we don't have the rights to this song.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. Today we are presenting the Pop-Tart Awards, the awards for excellence in pop culture in 2015. With me in the studio are...
Karen Tongson.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
It is time for our final one or two, I have yet to decide, Pop-Tarts of the categories. It is the award for best performance. This year, it's all girls. I'm sorry. I'm me. But there were two TV performances and two film performances that really just thrilled me. Constance Wu on Fresh Off the Boat, I've talked about a lot. I interviewed her on Bullseye because Jesse let me. I just feel like she came kind of out of nowhere. Like, talking to her, realizing just how few big deal opportunities she had had before this one, and was such a skilled and gifted actor. Like, both craft and soul was able to go into what she does on that show. And she really... there is always an edge on that show. There is always beautiful tension. Like, talking to her on Bullseye, asking her, it's like, oh, it's a show where people yell at each other. And her being like, yeah, that's what our culture is. Like, it would be rude not to. delightful. And then Gina Rodriguez on Jane the Virgin. That is an impossible task that is handed to her. Like, she is forced to deal with this melodrama that's going all over the place. She's dealing with other actors. The guy who plays her dad, Rogelio, is also pretty fucking amazing. But the fact that she has to manage all of that and play a character who's kind of one of those, oh, she's the smartest and the best and the nicest, but always just ground it, always just keep it real and relatable and honest. I love watching that show, and it is almost entirely – it's because of a lot of things, but she is an important one. And then when it comes to film, I've already gone through my process of watching Tangerine, thinking Maya Taylor was an amazing actress, and then half of the way through, realizing Katana Kiki Rodriguez was just going no holds barred. Like, that is a exciting and taxing performance. Like, that is a performance that is a lot to watch, and I watched the movie on a fucking iPhone. And it's glorious. And the other one is Jennifer Jason Leigh in The Hateful Eight. I think Hateful Eight is a really good movie. I think that the way it handles Jennifer Jason Leigh is a dangerous and difficult thing to watch, and I think that that was very intentional. I think in a film that is about law and equality, it is making some interesting points about the place of women in America and the place of women in America in the 1870s. But Jennifer Jason Leigh is alive in an electrifying way every moment that she's on screen. And it's not just a noble, magnificent performance of the Cate Blanchett variety. It is funny. It is dirty. It involves snot. And it's just this glorious reminder that Jennifer Jason Leigh can do all of that stuff. And we had her in a fucking Lifetime movie a couple of years ago. We've been wasting bitch.
Yes, seriously.
California
underused.
With a K.
Like, it really was sort of wonderful to see this guy who's been making movies for the past 20 years and started out by resurrecting the career of a guy who had kind of gone to seed, go back to the lady who was the darling of 1994 and say, hello, come in, please take care of this. And in a film full of amazing actors, she was extraordinary. There is a scene near the end where she's been knocked around for 3 hours. She has almost nothing left. And she fills herself with a power and capacity to go into this negotiation scene that is amazing. No one else could have done it. It was pretty great. Oliver, who are you going to throw down with?
So when I first saw the category, I read it more as performer of the year. And the two that I had, neither of whom are from the world of – well, actually, I guess one is from the world of television of sorts. But it would either be Steph Curry if you want to go positive or Donald Trump if you want to go negative. I mean, I think Steph Curry's accomplishments kind of speak for themselves. MVP – his team won the championship. His fall was incredible, record-breaking. One of the most dynamic athletes I've seen in a generation. But unfortunately, I got to say that if Black Lives Matter was my pop merit, what would you call it? Merit?
The Tarte de Merit.
Thank you. Yeah. Of the year.
De Merit.
Then, de Merit. I don't speak French.
Then Trump would have to be on the opposite side of it, and that I mean, what he has done politically is very much about performance, and it is him drawing upon his years of being in front of the camera and becoming this demagogue for unabashed white supremacy, which I find obviously distasteful and dangerous, but also sort of an incredible performance.
It is technically magnificent. People have, after a decade of talking shit about the Kardashians, somebody came from the world of Kardashians, walked up to the institution that runs our lives, and used those skills to be on his way to being a major player in it in a way that is fucking horrifying, but is a great performance.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm a little skeptical about whether or not he actually has the amount of political support that people think he does. But I think from a media point of view, his impact has been tremendous.
Well, you know that polling is a leak. Like, you can't do right. it on yeah. cell right. phone numbers, right?
Right.
So, I mean, right
That's
there
why,
you
yeah.
just know
but,
that it's
– But it's no question on a media level, the media loves Trump. He has
yes,
worked
yes.
that system over, like, better than almost anyone I can imagine.
One of Barbara Walters' most fascinating people in 2015.
Exactly. But if I had to go with actual television and film, I mean – I can certainly get behind Constance. I can get behind Gina Rodriguez. I mean, the person I thought of that would also be maybe be Ellie Kemper from Kimmy Schmidt. And again, that's part of the surprise factor. I don't feel like she got to spread her wings very much on The Office.
Yeah.
And Kimmy Schmidt's given her like this vehicle for it's like, oh, you can actually do a lot.
Well, it's almost honestly a Gina Rodriguez situation of having all of this shit bounce around you and it just all hangs off of her.
Right.
Mm. Margaret, what about you?
Well, for film, I would say Paul Dano as a young Brian Wilson in Love and Mercy because it's just one of those performances that just seems like it is from another world almost. Like he completely transforms into this character without stepping into caricature, which I think is so hard to do in a biopic where we know the person, we know what Brian Wilson, how he presents, and it could be easy to just kind of drift into mockery or mimicry. And it is not like that at all. It just is completely this individual, powerful, understated performance that just makes me feel like I Paul Dano, I will watch anything he does. Mm. You know, as far as TV goes, I mean, the most spellbinding scene that I saw this whole year on any TV show was Carrie Coon and Regina King on The Leftovers. So the two of them are neighbors on the show, and they both are dealing with a type of loss. I'm not going to give away more than that. But they're dealing with a type of loss, and they get together in this living room and talk about it. And the kind of power dynamics that pass back and forth between the two of them are just really gripping and really well done. Like, both of them are just completely in control of the scene and bouncing off of each other. The writing is just completely top-notch. I mean, the show is a really fascinating show in that it's so much about grief. It's so much about loss. It's the ways that we deal with those tricky and troubling emotions. And you just see the two of them kind of even pass through many stages of grief within the conversation together.
Regina yeah. King in anything is,
yeah.
is
pretty great.
Amazing.
Well, and also last year at the Emmys, I think it was that reminder that TV movies and miniseries have always been that space where our Black actors and actresses who are underserved by mainstream TV and film get to do their work and prove what they're capable of doing. Because yeah. She won for something last
year.
Yeah,
she did win last year.
I have no idea what it was.
I know. I'm trying to remember. But I was really excited.
Karen, what about you?
Okay, so TV. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Maura Tierney, ride or die, forever and ever. Mm. I love you. Amen. Mm. You know, Maura Tierney in The Affair has such a beautiful repertoire of disaffected expressions that speak volumes about middle-aged female heterosexuality, about, you know, being a beautiful person who is consigned to not being a beautiful person in certain moments and yet also held up as some sort of bourgeois ideal. I think that Maura Tierney's work in general throughout the arc of her career has always been very kind of laconic and subtle and just amazing. And in The Affair, she really has the room to kind of spread her wings, particularly the episode where her character Helen just lets herself go and gets shit-faced and sings Lucinda Williams and smokes too much weed and gets her hair done and gets in a car accident. I mean, that is a tour de force. I would be surprised if she didn't win the Emmy for Best Supporting Actress. I think that she's done incredible work throughout the arc of her career. And in TV this year, I think there's no person who's matched that level of performance. In film, I mean, you know, Best Lead, Cate Blanchett. I'm not going to say too much about that. I mean, I'm probably biased. And I'm also probably biased about my Best Supporting Actress in a film choice, Kristen Stewart, in The Clouds of Sils Maria. In fact, because I think this is the best cinematic role she's ever had, insofar as it at once taps into her intelligence, as well as some level of her naivete and also her really profound tomboyishness. It's
and
made
like
to
this prickly aspect.
It's a prickly tomboyishness that's made to work in a supernaturalistic way that it still seems like an elevation of the character. And, you know, I really wish more people would have seen that film because I think it really is her best performance. So there you go. And Paul Dano, I agree with you. Like, that was a transformative viewing experience to see him as Brian Wilson in Love and Mercy.
All right, I'm going to unilaterally say that in my purview as host, to show respect for Karen and Winter's absent regard for for The Affair, that we're going to give an award, uncertain regard, to Maura Tierney.
You go, Maura. You deserve it, honey.
a special award to Maura Tierney, mainly just because I don't think the rest of us have seen The Affair, right?
I have not. Well, I really want to.
News radio, ER, the whole deal.
Well, no, the thing is
I do love
the Worcester Group shows.
I love Maura Tierney. Mm-hmm. All right. Are there any of these that we think we can find consensus on? Are there any?
Are you talking about the film ones?
The
performances.
I shouldn't have squished these together. We didn't know what we were doing. It's our first year.
Yeah.
Let's start out with TV. Of TV performances, are there any?
Oh, so you were just giving more like, regardless, you get like
the Irving Thalberg award.
Yeah, yes, like a half a Pop-Tart. Yeah.
I'm giving her yes.
The Thalberg.
In the way that the Canjoy doesn't give supporting actor awards, but they do sort of like extraordinary. I believe it's called In Certain Regard or something like that. Mm. But like Samuel L. Jackson for Pulp Fiction, yeah. And Dame Helen Mirren for The Madness of King George. It's like, this person was so amazing. Yes.
Well, I was going to say, okay, if we're talking about TV, I could get behind Constance Wu. Okay. I do think because...
I'll also get behind Constance Wu.
Yeah, like, it's just...
I know you will.
In the similar way to, like, Kendrick Lamar, it's, like, just her year. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just, like, she's out there, she's shining.
And not even nominated for a Golden Globe.
Really?
I can't believe that.
Well, the Golden Globes, it is the thing of there's so much television out there,
yeah.
And the Golden Globes want famous people to come to their party. Like, that's the trouble with it. Usually they'll get excited about new shows, but she doesn't even have the benefit of being new because she was mid-season last year. Like last year they got Gina Rodriguez and they ended up giving her the Golden Globe.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit sad, but
I'm down with Constance.
All right. Constance Wu, consensus? All right.
Let's lock and load.
I'm not going to disagree with Constance.
The Pop-Tart for Best Performance Television goes to Constance Wu for Fresh Off the Boat.
Woo-hoo.
All right. Now let's talk about the much muddier field of Best Film Performance. Cate Blanchett is pretty amazing in Carol. I didn't see the Beach Boys movie.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any floating around out there that you think could be a consensus? John Boyega was pretty exciting.
I mean,
I don't think
I don't think he's the best, but I did want to give a quick acknowledgement to three different British actors who had to step into major franchises and I think did an amazing job. Rebecca Ferguson in Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, I think, kind of stole the show from Tom Cruise for a relative nobody. Now, I mean, that film at the end of the year is just not going to end up having much of an impact, but I thought she was fantastic in it. But Daisy Ridley and John Boyega had to step into, at this point, the biggest franchise on the planet as relative unknowns. And they did really good jobs.
They were charming as fuck.
Yes.
Speaking of charming as fuck, there also Tiana Paris from Chirac, something that the three of us have seen, who was in a movie that was all over the place, but who yet again was that person who held it all together in a way that was pretty amazing.
And you could just tell, regardless of what you think about that movie, that she's going to be a star.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, you could just see it radiating off
of her. I hated that
movie,
but I could roll with her.
All right. We're horse trading at this point in time.
I defer to the OG three.
Are there any other of these performances that you think you could, like, connect with and say, yes, this was the best performance of the year?
Yeah, I did love Daisy Ridley. I think she
Katanaki.
Was... What?
Oh, all right. What about that? Should we push that through? What?
Katana Kiki Rodriguez.
Are the two of us more enthusiastic about Katana Kiki Rodriguez?
I can't get behind it.
Why?
I think that her acting was not that good.
A lot of people have said that it was bad acting. I think it was astoundingly honest acting.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think she was really fresh and open in this way that I do admire. But
yes.
I just also feel like she couldn't ever change her facial expression.
All right.
It's as honest, though, as Daisy Ridley's ability to step into that particular role as a trained actress. That's all I have to say.
How do you mean?
I mean, I just think that, you know, Daisy Ridley, she's great and she's like charming and attractive and all these different things. But, you know, many people of her range and training and probably
right.
like ability could
yes.
have filled that role. So
it wasn't a
in terms of like weighing the gravity or greatness of the performance, I would say Katana Kiki Rodriguez is, amateurish, and I'm not saying that in a bad way.
Yeah.
Expression and performance in Tangerine is on par with somebody of that
right.
status.
Oliver, you've seen one of these films.
I would go with Katana Kiki Rodriguez because she has the best name of anybody here by far. And, you know, that goes a long way. So, and anyone who's named Katana and has Kiki as their middle name, I mean, come on.
Like, I very much respect Margaret's veto, but I feel like nobody's as enthusiastic in this room about Tiana Paris as I am about Katana Kiki Rodriguez.
I think it's time for you to, like, give a tart out.
All right.
I mean, I'm just going to look the other way. I can't watch this tart be given. I cannot support this tart. I'm sorry.
All right. There.
She's going to come and kick my ass. I'm sorry.
With dissent. Katana Kiki Rodriguez, congratulations on the first Pop-Tart for Best Performance in a Film. All right. You are listening to the Pop-Tarts on Pop Rocket. Right after this, we're going to have the exhausting conversation of what the single best pop culture thing from the past year was. Please stick around.
Hey, I'm Erin Gibson.
I'm Brian Safi.
And we host Throwing Shade, a weekly look at all the issues that are important to ladies and gays and anybody else who cares about that stuff. And we make funnies.
Yeah, either you care or you don't.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. We tonight are presenting the Pop Tarts, the awards for the greatest achievements in pop culture in 2015. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for you to listen to our deliberations about the most prestigious of those awards, the Tarte d'Or, granted to the single greatest thing in pop culture from the past year. Karen Tongson, what do you think the single greatest thing from pop culture last year was?
I think the greatest sort of hangover taste of the mouth left after 2015, good and bad, is the sense of the emergence of the lady squad or the hashtag squad. Starting in the beginning of the year with Taylor and her band of like new Stepfordettes to also just the emergence of so many amazing kind of female pairs and personalities, female comics in general
together. Unreal.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, Amy and Tina doing their thing, Kate McKinnon, like ruling the airwaves with every bit of improvisation she, you know, and every role she played on SNL. And so I do think that there's something linked to, again, my meme of the year, the notion of these various kind of feminist hashtags that is at once like really kind of amazing. There's a real consciousness around femininity, also around like, these amazing kind of female-centered films that close the year out, like Carol or like Clouds of Sils Maria. But just that's in the zeitgeist and that's in the air and that's important and that's really wonderful. At the same time, I still also always, as a gender studies professor, as a queer woman of color who moves through this world, always hope for a more expansive idea, a more intersectional idea of what the hashtag lady squad or hashtag squad means. There you go.
Oliver, what about you?
I would still stick with Black Lives Matter for all the reasons I laid out at the front end. I mean, I can get behind lady squads. I think it was a very good year for women, not just as individuals, but I think for all the reasons that Karen just laid out. So I'm not opposed to it. And I think really they're both kind of part of a similar parallel set of trends, which is that for communities that have oftentimes dwelled on the margins, there was a feeling that there was much more of a kind of a bum rushing of the center. Mm-hmm. And it's not like we've taken over the center, but in a very clear way. And I think that's something that when I think back upon 2015, both of those things will be very resonant in that respect.
Margaret.
Well, in a way, I think we're all getting at a similar thing. What I would approach it as is like finding voice. Certain marginalized groups really finding their voice this year. And it's embodied for me in two different magazine covers. One being the Call Me Caitlin, Bruce Jenner's, you know, full-on transformation to Caitlin on Vanity Fair. That just felt like this incredible moment of trans representation. And, you know, certainly Caitlin has had her fair share of missteps this year, but I still think the visibility gained from that was really tremendous. And in general, just like this sort of explosion of trans visibility of what we're talking about with Tangerine and Transparent. The other magazine cover that I think about is New York Magazine's I'm No Longer Afraid cover that was all of the or a group of Bill Cosby's victims stepping forward and telling their stories and having their photographs taken. And that is such a rare and positive change from the way we think about victims of rape, you know, that these women were stepping forward, that they weren't ashamed, that they were like, this is what happened to me. And, you know, just to see the whole crazy story that's been happening with Bill Cosby, I mean, it just keeps cycling through different stages. And I feel like we're at this new place of people who have been shamed or silenced or told that their opinions don't matter are now getting to speak up. And I think about it too with, you know, Black Lives Matter and even somebody like Monica Lewinsky kind of being this shamed and silenced person for, you know, decades now, coming out in the last year or two and really reclaiming some kind of dignity and some kind of space and saying this was not okay, what happened to her. So for me, it's really about voices. And, you know, what you guys are talking or what you were talking about, Karen, with the squad, you know, the only I mean, I love that there are all these women banding together and uniting and helping each other. I think the negative aspect to me about the squad is the sort of cliquishness. Mm-hmm. That's the one part of it that I can't quite get behind. And that's what I see so much with like Taylor's crew. It just feels like this.
Who gets to be a squad or who gets called terrorists or aggressors?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that whole thing, right? I mean, it's a sort of like who in a collective is recognized as a squad or as a collective versus who is still a precarious subject, subjected to violence by the state and by hate and all of these things.
Yeah, so that's my one kind of tag about the squad that I wanted to bring up.
I'm going to stick with man buns. I'm going to say that this year they had their moment, either that or that time in the MLB playoffs when that dude bounced the ball off of the batter's bat while he was – when the catcher threw the ball and it hit the bat and then it bounced away and no one knew what to do. Do you remember that?
I do, actually.
It was pretty great. All right. Yes, Oliver, what were you?
I want to revisit at least the three previous points. No offense to you, Guy. And I'm going to use this as a way of reclaiming a term that's largely used as a pejorative, but I think might link a lot of the themes that we're talking about, which is it was the year of the social justice warrior. Mm-hmm. And that the ways in which groups, communities are making their voices heard, to borrow from what you're saying, Margaret, in a way that was – I mean, and I don't mean to pick on your choice of words. I don't think it's that people found their voice. It's like their voice is like lost somewhere. Oh, look, it's there on the ground. No, it's that people forced – the rest of us, the rest of society, to listen to those voices, which then has sparked, and this brings it back to Donald Trump and all, you know, the other kinds of reactionary politics mm-hmm. that we've seen as a consequence. This was the year in which the notion of social justice became a meme to itself that had to be reacted to. But that suggests that the idea of social justice itself permeated like so many layers of the zeitgeist, et cetera.
I will stand behind Squad as the most pop culture-y of iterations of that, that it was this beautiful journey that we all got to watch of Taylor Swift mm-hmm. saying, I'm not a feminist. Lena Dunham and other pop culture, like women in pop culture, reaching out and saying, hey, let's have a conversation. Not a marginalizing conversation. We're not going to tell you why you're wrong. We're going to talk to you. And then it achieving a form that is very poppy, a form that is like does smell of mean girliness and a lot of these things that are tropes that we have thought to think of as negative, but
it looks good on a sweatshirt.
But it looks good on it looks good on a sweatshirt. And the thing is that so much of our application of, oh, they're coming to assimilate you, oh, they are the cool girls who doesn't get to be part of the squad, that was kind of never what Taylor Swift was throwing at you the whole time. It was way too many people on stage at all times. It was way too many people in the Bad Blood video. And I really felt like a lot of these things are interesting, good concepts to the people who are on our Facebook feeds, but it is also the stuff that reaches people beyond our Facebook feeds that is really important. And if the lesson of you get to be a feminist, that's not a bad thing. Supporting other women and caring about them matters has changed the world in a lot of really nice ways.
And supporting racial social justice and speaking out against, you know, police violence. I mean, you know, in the ways in which something like the idea of like your benign Instagram hashtag squad like presents itself as, you know, is just like a kind of iteration of like, you know, this is like some sort of casual collective, we look cute, whatever, it still is adjacent to or relates to these other larger consequential issues that have been dredged up by the fact that people are, in the wake of late capitalism, starting to imagine these other collective possibilities and forms and affiliations and emergences. I don't know. That just sounds way too hippy-dippy. But like, I do feel that like the squad is one version of that. Sometimes it's a bad version. Sometimes it's the cliquey version. And, you know, but like that there are, again, as Oliver was saying, these popular people always kind of critique the hashtagging of these justice women, but they're effective insofar as it hails people and brings them together.
All right, Margaret, give us a hard sell on what were two public comings out. They were two public comings out that weren't about sexuality. They were about gender identity and they were about sexual violence and mm-hmm. how – what place that has in popular culture. Sell us on your concept.
Well, I just think of it as being these two voices who were always told to shut up and be quiet, like basically to disappear. Like if you get raped, you're supposed to disappear and not talk about it. Your name doesn't ever get printed in the paper. You're not supposed to be an entity after that.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that these women stepped forward against a very powerful figure, you know, it wasn't just some random person, obviously. It was against one of the most powerful pop culture father-like figures that we've had. And, you know, it just seemed to me this complete...
She's talking about Kris Jenner.
It just seemed to me this complete shift in terms of, like, how we think of victims of something like rape. So to sort of take all that shame out of it. And, I mean, maybe in one sense the link, too, is about shame. You know, when you go over to the Caitlyn Jenner side of things, like, here is this man who was completely defined by his masculinity, defined by being a great athlete, defined by being a father and a man and so forth. And, you know, this whole life that he's been leading was a secret and something he wasn't ever supposed to talk about. And then he comes out in this way that I think was really powerful in terms of saying, no, I'm not going to be silenced. I'm not going to just like do this in a closet from, you know, 10 at night to midnight until I go to bed and keep it a secret. It's out here now.
The tragedy that we watched her experience on the edge of these other women's stories is so fascinating and telling for 7 goddamn seasons. Mm-hmm. All right, Oliver, Black Lives Matter, very, very socially and politically important this year. Sell us on the pop. Give us the pop elements of Black Lives Matter. You got your Dear White People. You have a lot of important presentation in music. Where do you think it came alive most?
Well, I think it goes back to what I said at the very beginning, which is that it's a social movement that also began through social media, and to the extent in which our pop culture is socially mediated at all times, it feels like, that it's sort of one of the most powerful and kind of purely organic examples.
But rooted in the big stuff. Rooted in the big stuff as well. What
big stuff? Were you?
I'm talking about music. I'm talking about
like big pop stuff.
Dear White People. I'm talking about like
or Chirac. I mean,
Chirac. Yeah,
was forced to acknowledge it. Sure. I mean, it appears in. I get what you're saying. To me, like
I'm saying, which of those was good?
But to me, its bigness transcends like specific categories. I mean, I'm using a very broad definition of pop here. Because I think that as time has – what pop means these days is so fluid. It's not confined to sort of conventional genres, even though obviously that's what we tend to talk about here. But something in terms of, again, the idea that it permeates our daily interactions with meaning, with pleasure, with pain, that to me is pop. And so Black Lives Matter as one example. I'm not going to argue it's the only one that's worth talking about. But I think that to the extent that, yes, you can find – musicians and rappers, singers, whatever reacting to it. You can find directors and actors and actresses, television, film, you know, et cetera. Maybe, I don't know about video games. That might be a tough sell. But certainly in the realm of sports.
It just takes longer to develop a video game.
There we go. In 4 years.
In four years.
We'll have something about it. But right, in the sports world, it was, you know, with the participation of athletes. So
LeBron James.
Yeah. And I also think, and this goes back to sort of Karen's point, the difference, for me at least, between it and Squad is I think – Black Lives Matter has been more intersectionally adaptive than Squad has been.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have to make a call here. Would anybody like to come out and say that they are willing to support a different camp?
I mean, I can get behind Squad as – I mean, I'm tired of the word.
I'm with you too on that,
you know, where I'm just like – I'm tired of like Squad goals.
As an affirmative, but just as a phenomenon. I mean, I think that's one of the things that
I mean. If we're just
deciding, is like, is this like, are we affirming the thing that we select, or are we just like acknowledging its effect?
Somewhere in between, the hazy territory in between, Karen. That's what we do, both as culture watchers and as culture makers.
It is all haze.
I think part of my bias too is I feel like it came out too early in the year, so its resonance at this point, talking in January 2016. For me, seeing at least the word itself, that was like early 2015. A year later, I'm like, eh.
I think it was just here more. I mean, it was only August that we had Taylor showing up at the VMAs to heal her hurts with Nicki Minaj before Nicki Minaj turned around and unhealed her hurts with Miley Cyrus. All right, you guys. Am I just steamrolling this convention?
I think we're just going to have to go with man buns. That's the only solution to this dilemma.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Tarte d'Or for 2015 is now respectfully presented to hashtag squad. Taylor, if you or any members of the squad, except for Cara, what's her name? Cara Delevingne?
Yeah.
Cara Delevingne want to come and receive your award, which does not exist.
See, we're She's already go by Cara being Delevingne. Clickish and not allowing her to come in.
Cara has to go buy a real sweatshirt otherwise. That's all I have to say.
All right, you guys. You guys have been listening to the first annual Pop-Tart Awards here on Pop Rocker, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Waffler, Oliver Wang, and Karen Thompson, in for Winter Mitchell. We will post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Boop Chat by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to every one of you who reviewed us for the past year. We appreciate it a lot, but mostly to Public Emily. And thank you guys for helping spread the word about our show by telling friends. We've reached or are about to reach 1 million downloads over the past year, which
is
crazy and exciting and really, really great. So thanks for helping us out by telling your friends, subscribing to it on demo phones in the Apple Store, or tweeting about us. I don't know what demo phones on the iPhone. I don't know what that means, Colin. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. Our producers are the tart-worthy Colin Anderson and the very new but still charming Christian Duenas. And thank you to all of us for listening to us, because we're about to hit our 1 millionth download.
Yay!
Yeah!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.